and she'll tell us her story. Live from Omaha, Nebraska, Saturday Night Live.
Hi, I'm Kathleen. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Kathleen.
I'm a little bit intimidated by this microphone thing, so I'm going to... I am actually kind of tired. I've been working a lot today, so I may sit down as we go along if I get real tired, if you guys don't mind. When you get to be my age, I guess, people feel sorry for you and they don't worry about stuff like that as much. I was kind of doing some preparation for this morning and then later on today. And I have told my story in bits and pieces in other meetings and maybe at a Super Saturday or two. So I was hoping I could come up with something new, but it's still sort of the same life. I mean, there's some things I can't change. But I think I will highlight a few things tonight that maybe are newer for me or maybe just more, I have more recognition of them or something. So I'll try and spice it up a little bit and talk about some things I may not have mentioned before. I don't recall compulsive eating until I was about 16. Now, I may have done it before that, I just don't recall it. I'm the oldest of 9 kids, and my family is generally a slender family. I have one grandmother who I think probably was a compulsive eater and was quite obese. But and when we were growing up, I didn't see other people using food abnormally. And as far as I recall, I did not either. But as I say, I may not have remembered everything. But I do remember my dad was alcoholic, and there was a lot of violence in our home when we were all growing up. And grew up with a lot of fear. In fact, fear is probably something that I still struggle with to a large extent even now. I tell people I don't get hit anymore, but the fear of getting hit is still kind of there, you know, even though it's probably not going to happen. So that fear stuff is something I have struggled with since I was certainly a kid. And one of the sort of the stable people, and there were others as well. There were lots of loving people in my family too. But one of the stable people in my life was my grandfather. And I was the oldest kid, and I kind of was a little bit of the apple of his eye probably. And the day he died was a very traumatic day for me. I think probably he was providing some, you know, more than stability, maybe not just for me, but certainly for me. And the day he died, I was raised in a small town in western Nebraska, and this is sort of typical for small towns, I think, at least in our area, is that people brought over enormous amounts of food. All of a sudden, our kitchen was laden with food. Well, at the risk of naming a binge food, I picked up a pan of cake, and took it down to the basement where my bedroom was, and I ate the entire cake. And I had never in my life that I recall had done anything like that before. And it was clearly related to his death and to this food being in the house. And it was, I mean, I feel like the alcoholic who knew they were alcoholic on the first drink. Well, I knew that there was something different about this, and I was off and running. And I've really, since that night, and I can even look and tell you the date, but in any case, that my relationship with food changed dramatically from that day forward. And I probably did a lot of the things that some of you would say you did too. I mean, I could, the gory stories are pretty gory. People often ask me like what my top weight was, and frankly, I don't know, because at one point I just stopped weighing. But what I can tell you is that for the rest of high school, my weight skyrocketed. I had been sort of, actually kind of almost on the skinny side before that, and my weight just skyrocketed. My family was just shocked, because overnight it just seemed like I went to high school during the days when the girls all had to wear dresses. I don't know if anybody else remembers that besides me. But I had one dress that I could wear, and I wore it every day for the last, I don't know, for a long time, months. And the kids started, you know, I became an object of ridicule and people were making fun of me. And that was all new for me. I was, I was sort of a serious student and a good test taker, and so I think I was, my little niche in high school was being a good student probably. But I had never been object of that kind of ridicule, made fun of and laughed at, and it was a traumatic thing, that whole experience for me. And my mother was just, she didn't know what to think. I mean, it was just like this overnight. I think my dad knew intuitively what was going on because it was his mom who'd been massively obese, and he was, you know, drinking. And there was, even as a 16 or 17-year-old, I remember in the evening, he would walk downstairs to his bedroom to go to drink, and I would walk downstairs to my bedroom to go to eat. So the parallels were there and were so obvious, I really couldn't ignore them, you know, from that, you know, early time on. I think the experience that compulsive eating has generally left me with is one of tremendous shame. I mean, it's a big word, it's a big concept, but that's really the experience I had of just having no ability to control anything and just being completely ashamed of the way I looked. And so at some point, when I graduated from high school and went on to college, started doing this, what I would call restricting. I never was good enough at it to be anorexic, but I was certainly trying my best. And I would binge, and then I still ate, but I ate very restricted, like the same thing every day, at the same time every day, and would bring down my weight a little bit, and then I would take off, and it was just. I told a friend once, I was always on a diet, I was never on a diet, and it was the same thing. I was just really embarrassed and ashamed about the way that I looked. Didn't date much through high school or college, because I was too crazy to even, you know, be interested or interesting, and again, just kind of focused on getting good grades, and trying to control my food. And if I had every minute back that I spent obsessing about food and how I looked and how I wanted to look, I'd have years left in my life. It's a tremendous loss for me, just the amount of time that I spent wrapped up in this disease. And I used to draw these calendars, and I still find them every now and then, like 1972, and it's May, and I weighed every day, and I have the weights every day from that, you know, in that month, and it would go down, and then it would go up. It was just that kind of thing. So it was a very, it was an awful way to live, but it was mostly a very self-absorbed and kind of restricted way to live. I kept myself in a very narrow spot. I had a few friends, but not a whole lot. And I used to say that, you know, I was always down I lived in a dorm, and down in the laundry room, up and down, because there were the candy machines down there. I don't know if anybody else knows about candy machines besides me, but I was down to the candy machines, and by the time I'd walk up, I had it all eaten, and I'd be down to the candy machines, And I mean, I was eating enormous quantities. I was reading Step 2 today, and one of the things it said is, I ate to the point where I got full, I ate some more to the point where I got sick, and I kept eating and eating more and eating more. And that was just, I mean, that was true pretty much every day of my life. So I would wake up in the morning, you know, well-intentioned. It's not going to happen today. By 4 o'clock, I was binging. Binged till, you know, I went to bed. I was so sick, I had to stop. And then I'm not going to do this today. I'm going to do something different tomorrow. So I wake up with this plan. Like, I was going to take a shower in the morning rather than in the evening. That was, like, what difference does that make? But I did those sort of artificial things as part of an effort to control my behavior. The another thing that jumped out at me from step two this morning is I disfigured and maimed my body. And boy, I have been blessed in life with really good health. And almost every health problem I've ever had was related to binging and the stuff that goes along with binging. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. But I really did. I disfigured my body. I hurt my body. And what a precious gift we all have. And to do that was just devastating. I'd come home for summer break at a certain weight and go back to school 30 or 40 or 50 pounds heavier. I mean, just in a couple of months, it was just obsessive, crazy. I finished college and then did a couple years working, and then I went back to like a graduate school type thing and was in more school for 4 years. And during that time, I actually fell in love for the first time. And it was at one of my skinnier, not skinny, but skinnier moments. And I felt like I could actually, you know, I could give it a try with this guy and hopefully it would work out. Well, you know, it didn't work out and all that kind of stuff. But then after that disappointment, then the food just took off and the weight, it was just unbelievable. So, I mean, it was just shocking how I would go from 1 week or month or year to another and the change in my appearance. I remember having like 4 or 5 different sizes of clothing. Like I had the size that I would never get into, but I always kept it in my closet just in case. And then I had the next size up and then the next size up. And I would have, you know, 4 or 5 sizes. And if there was, let's just say there was a wedding coming up, I never knew which size I was going to be able to get into for the wedding. So it was just, you know, I just hoped I could get into something that looked like it was appropriate for a wedding. But it was that kind of craziness. Then I finished graduate school, and at that point actually worked overseas for a little while. And working overseas in a country that doesn't have a lot of food is a great place for a compulsive overeater. Now that is not why I went, I promise, but I got there and I lost an enormous amount of weight because there's not enough food. People are not binging because there's no food. And while I was there, met somebody that I fell in love with and I actually eventually married. But we came back to the States, and see, he thought I was sort of a healthy, normal eater, and I got back to the States and I just exploded. And he was sitting there going, oh my God, you know, what's going on here? Well, we decided to get married, and this would have been in 1980. And I knew I did not want, I've said this in other meetings, and I apologize for the repetition, but I knew I did not want to get married as fat as I was at that time. I knew that. So my future sister-in-law, and this is, I think, the best service that's ever been done for me, kind of wrote me a letter, welcomed me into the family. And she said, you know, I am doing something really neat for myself. She lives in the Cleveland area. She says, I'm going to OA. And she explained it to me in a letter. And I thought, wow, that sounds like it's what I need. So I was living in Kansas City at the time. And there were 4 OA meetings in the city. I found one that was actually fairly close to where I lived. And went to the first OA meeting in September of 1980. And there were 3 other women in that meeting, and it was in a church basement. And that group, the 4 of us, met once a week, pretty much every week for a year. And I am so grateful those women were there. I'm so grateful that I went to that first meeting, that my sister-in-law told me about it. And then I went back. And really, for the first year, I didn't do a whole lot right. But I did do a couple things right, and one was I went back. I mean, that was a good thing for me to do. The other is that I asked one woman to be my sponsor, I mean, almost immediately, and I have no idea why that is. At that time, there were what we call food sponsors and step sponsors, and it doesn't really matter. But anyway, I picked her to be my food sponsor. And I started a food plan, and she said, call me every night with your food plan, and I started doing that. She said, call me if you change it. So I called her if I changed it. So that first year, I was very faithful about that part of the program. I called her virtually every night. I called her most of the time when I was going to change something. And when I made a commitment at that point with the food, I stuck with it. And that just, what that did for me is it gave me all kinds of success in terms of the food early on. And I actually think that was important for me. I don't know if it would be for anybody else, but it was for me because I felt like, oh my gosh, there's something hopeful about this experience. So I got to a healthy weight. I was reading the Big Book. At that time we had the Big Book and maybe one and the White Meditation Book, and that may be just about it, and the Brown Book we used to call the Chocolate Book. But I was reading the Big Book, and I was reading the Meditation Book each day, or the little daily reflection book, and calling this sponsor every day. And I felt hopeful. And that was, I think that's one of the biggest differences for me between recovery and disease is hope. And I guess that's what I want. If there are relative newcomers here, I want people to hear that. There is, in my world, there's tremendous hope in OA and in recovery, and there's tremendous despair in the disease. And that is, for me, that's just a completely different way to live, those two ways. And I've lived in both. And lived in both since I came to LA. But anyway, it was a good experience. I felt hopeful. And then at the end of that year, my husband and I got married, and we immediately moved to a different city. And I have to say, the moving has been hard for me in LA. I'm kind of, I'm sort of a shy person, and it's hard for me to sort of, when I get into a new place, it's hard for me to kind of, you know, reach out. So the move was tough for me. We moved to a different city, and we were newly married. There was other things happening, and I did not go back to OA for 2 years. And that was one of the silliest mistakes I've ever made in the program. So I had really good experience with the program, some success, and didn't go back. And I was sick. Those 2 years were miserable because the food took off almost immediately. I started having migraine headaches at that time, which I think are, in my case, almost purely related to binging on sugar, which is sort of my drug of choice. And I found that my life, it was even more chaotic than it had been before I came to OA, and there's probably a number of reasons for that, but it was a very scary time for me. But I didn't go back to OA, and I mean, I think I have excuses for why I didn't. I don't think I can really explain very well why I didn't go back for 2 years, but I didn't. And then at the end of 2 years, things for me were falling apart in a number of arenas, and so I started looking for OA meetings. This was a larger city, and there were a number of meetings. I got started going back after 2 years, and I've been going to meetings then ever since that, which would be, I think, 1983. So I've been going to OA since then. Now, I can tell you when I went back, my food did not stabilize as quickly or as well as it had during that first year. I had a lot of fits and starts. I'd get a week in, or I'd get a month in, or I'd get 2 days in, and it would just be, I was fighting it a lot. I had a sponsor, was much more intent on working the steps at this point, which I had done some of before, but really hadn't really jumped right in, and did my first fourth step during the next year or two after that, probably, and continued to work the steps. And it really wasn't until November 22nd, 1985, I did a very important ninth step with a family member. And the day after that, the compulsion to eat sugar was completely removed and has never come back. So I am so fortunate that I haven't binged on sugar since November 23rd, 1985. And that is really not something I'm terribly proud of, because frankly, I don't really think it has anything to do with anything about me. I'm just grateful. That's what I experience. And for a long time, I couldn't have sugar in the home. A lot of foods I couldn't have in the home. And I'm not boasting, but when I had subsequently, you know, kids and stuff, and we started having sugar in the house, and it really doesn't. I mean, I used to know probably almost to the eighth of a teaspoon how much sugar-laden food there was in my house at any one time. And I had it, if I didn't have it hidden, I had it so far back, nobody else would have seen it. But it's funny, now I find sugar, you know, stuff around the house, and I wasn't aware that it was, that's a miracle. That is miracle. Because I couldn't get past 4 o'clock without binging. And I'm telling you, I would buy bags of things like this and eat them. And it wouldn't be one bag. I mean, I'm talking enormous quantities. So that is unquestionably a miracle of this program. And I think it's really related to the step work. So when people, sometimes when I'm sponsoring people, they ask me, well, what do you do first or what do you do second? And it's hard for me to know how to answer those questions. I just know that for me, it wasn't a coincidence that I lost the desire to eat sugar the day after I did this ninth step. I can't promise anything like that will happen to anybody else. I just know that was my experience, and I really haven't had the urge to eat sugar since that day. It's just different. It's just a different way of living. So it's something that I can't explain beyond that. I wish I could tell you then, since that date, nothing bad's happened to me. But there have been some bad things that happened along the way. And the nice thing is that I've had the support, and I've had a clear head through most of it. And I've had a relationship with my higher power, whom I call God. Infertility was a huge issue for me. And my husband and I ended up adopting two, when I was there, beautiful, beautiful children. But then eventually I ended up in a divorce, which was completely unexpected and really devastating in my life. And have had other challenges like anybody else has had. This program, there aren't any challenges. You know, those things continue to happen. I have challenges today before I came over here tonight. So all this does is give me a way of living in that maybe disappointment or sadness or loss or pain or whatever it is that's going on. What I have found in my life is I actually work in the addiction field. I do that as a job. And so I guess one of the things that I really value in this program is the anonymity. I am very careful about my anonymity because of both the work I do and also because I really don't want to be lifted up as anything other than a person who schleps in this room like everybody else, struggles through every day, and, you know, schleps back out. So I don't view myself as having any, I don't have anything special. All I have is my experience. One of the things I have, because I'm in this field, I do a lot of reading in it and learning about it. And one of the things that I was thinking of this morning as I was thinking about this tonight is in the addictions field, there are people now who say there's sort of three things that tend to provoke relapse. And this makes a lot of sense to me from my experience. One of them is stress. The other are cues or triggers. And then the third is a slip. And stress is, so I think whatever I can do to minimize stress in my life is really supporting my recovery. Well, part of that means, you know, it's sort of like something, you know, people irritate or they get cranky or they do this or that. You know, that stuff actually doesn't bother me much anymore. I don't notice it even. So I don't have much of a temper. I don't have reason to get angry most of the time, because it really no longer bothers me that much. Now, I wish I could tell you that there aren't other things that are stressful, but I think having a way to deal with stress or to minimize stress, I think it's been really helpful for me. And that's something I work at, and I'll maybe talk more about that in a minute. But stress is one. The other are cues or triggers. And 4 o'clock in the afternoon used to be a real trigger for me. And to some extent, it still is. So I have a ritual of something that I do about that time to help me through that hour or two. And that's important for me. Another trigger for me is anxiety. I think that's going back to that childhood fear stuff. So I have tools, and again, maybe talk more about them in a minute, about how to deal with anxiety. I'm in therapy. I've been in therapy for years. And a large part of what my therapy has been is to sort of deal with anxiety so that I don't want to do something, you know, destructive to deal with that. And then a slip is the third thing. And, you know, clearly for me, I abstain from all, my goal is to abstain from all mood-altering food. And in my case, that means obviously sugar. So I'm a label reader, still am. So anything, any product that has a sugar or a sugar-like thing in the first 5 ingredients or so, I mean, that's not for me. That's just not. And now I kind of pretty much know what that is because I've been reading labels for 20-some years. But every once in a while, I'll think, now, is this in the first 5? And I go, oh, damn, it is. You know, because something new, a new product or something, I don't know. But generally, anything that's got sugar in the first, and obviously any of the sugar-laden foods, I don't even have to look at the label. But every once in a while, I have to look at the label and find out. Now, I have struggled with, you know, the crunchy, chippy, baggy stuff. That still has reared its ugly head with me, but that's something I need to abstain from completely. Otherwise, I mean, I have 3 meals a day. I have a very light, I'll just kind of walk through my day. I wake up, I've become a morning person because God's given me that gift. So I'm usually up around 5. I take an hour of prayer and meditation time in the morning unless I'm really, 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 really busy, and then I take an hour and a half. That's what one of our readings says to us. So I usually take about an hour, sometimes an hour and a half of prayer and meditation time in the morning. And I want to talk about meditation in a minute. And then I build in some exercise to my day. And that's been a real gift to this program. I am, like, not an athlete, okay? Don't even think. I have never been an athlete, never will be. But exercise has become a very important part of my program. So as weather permits, and today wasn't one of those, I go for a run each morning. And it is part of my prayer time. So that's when I do my listening. And I often love to do it. I only run by myself because I want to be able to hear. And I love to run in the dark or right when the sun is coming up because that's when I feel most in touch with God. I love being out there by myself and listening. So then I do make 2 OA calls each morning. I call someone with my food, and I call my sponsor. I eat a very light breakfast. I have a piece of fruit mid-morning. I have a lunch. Vegetables are really, I wish I were a natural vegetable eater, but I build in 2 large vegetables to my lunch each day. Otherwise, I probably would struggle with that. I have a fruit mid-afternoon, and then I have a lighter supper. So that's just kind of how I do things. I try and have a cup of tea or decaf coffee or something around 4 or 5. And when I get home, I make a point of going and sitting just quietly for a while. My kids are grown now. So those of you who have little kids, you can't do this. I know you can't. But my kids are grown now, so they don't want to spend any time with me anyway. They don't want to talk to me. So I go and sit, have a quiet moment in my chair and have some coffee or something or tea before supper. So that's kind of how. And then I do a 10th step each morning for the previous day. I try and make another call later in the day. I'm not as good at that as I would like to be. I call a food plan in each morning, and there's probably something else that I'm missing. But those are some kind of how I work some of the tools. I have a great sponsor. She wanted to be here tonight, but she had a family thing. And I, the thing I love about her is she is so full of integrity. I was a little bit scared of her at first because I thought, oh, gee, I cannot live up to this woman. She is so honest and she's so full of integrity. And I still can't. But she is the key thing about her is when I'm stuck in the mud, which I often am, she goes right to action. She says, what are the action steps you can take? Because, one of the characteristics of my disease is this head chatter. And maybe I'm the only one here who has it. But if I am left to my own devices, I am just spinning all the time up here. I think it's part of the anxiety struggles I have. And I was at a meeting one time where someone said, when you're in your, when I'm in my head, I'm behind enemy lines. And that is very much true for me. So that's why that quiet time is so important in the morning. The exercise alone is meditation, which I'll talk about in a minute. But she immediately takes me to action. I called her just this last week, and I was feeling really, like in the quicksand of a situation. And she immediately took me to action. I don't know that I do real well analyzing situations. I think that is probably a problem that I can get into very easily. But she really does steer me, and she has such a gentle way of doing it. That I really value that. And the nice thing now is I'm in my fourth or fifth city now in OA, and I've been here for now 18 years and had the same sponsor for most of that time. And that is just, for me, that's just a gift because I don't have to retell the story. She's been through a lot of that junk with me, so I really value that. I want to check the time. See what we're doing here. Can I just do a little bit more? Okay. I just wrote down some things that I value. I really value now not blaming myself or blaming somebody else or self-pity. I grew up in surrounded by a lot of self-pity. I think self-pity is really toxic for me, so it's important to me that I not do that. So part of my recovery is I'm brutally honest on my set with myself. Hopefully, a gentle spirit with others, and I don't blame. I mean, I really work hard at not blaming and not being into self pity. One of life's challenges for me is learning how to live with discomfort, whether the discomfort is betrayal or abandonment or anxiety or a lost love or whatever it is. I think that's what my life's journey is about, is learning how to deal with discomfort. And I do a lot of spiritual reading from other traditions, and it's something I'm kind of interested in. And what I'm struck by is how all those folks like back in 700 and 400, they knew about 12-step programs, And this journey that we're on is actually the journey that a lot of people have been on, but we just started with a little different, a little different impetus. But it's the same stuff. I'm hearing the same stuff in all these different religious and spiritual traditions, and I think, whoa, now she would never have been to an OA meeting. How did she know about that? But it's, so anyway, handling discomfort is acceptance, I think, is how, that's probably the life journey that some of us have to do. I think the other thing I'm aware of is, and this is something I decided for myself a while ago, is that part of my recovery is slowing down, I think, and this is from another tradition, but entering the space, listening carefully, speaking the truth, and letting go of the results. And that is so so true for me. And I'm in a busy work environment and life environment, as I'm sure almost all of you are. And just having quiet sometimes is so unusual. And so, for example, I almost never have the radio on in the car. I love nature, so I almost always have windows open, and I love listening to birds, and just I've become a gardener over the years, and I really think it's part of my spiritual life. It's just enjoying those sort of things. But the key thing for me is being what I would call exquisitely present in each moment. And that's why I have to slow down and quiet down. I said once in a meeting that, you know, I am not a firefighter. I do not have to race from one experience to another. And sometimes I'm just doing it in my head. But I've started to walk more slowly. I've started to look more slowly. I've started to listen more slowly. And all of that is part of my effort, I think, to be exquisitely present in each moment, so that I not just hear the words, but I hear the message. And for me, if there's a heightened awareness that goes along with that, that is a very different way of living. Being silent in our tasks, I think, is important. All those things where we get to hear God, you know, or at least that's how I hear God, is when I shut up here. About 12 years ago, or thereabouts, I started to gain some weight back. And I think I probably gained 10 or 12 pounds. I can't remember what it was exactly. But it got scary for me. And I thought, what am I doing wrong? What's happening here? And I had to really look at my food. And so it took me a while to get there. At the same time, Lifeline had an article on fat serenity. I don't know if anybody remembers that article. But it was a really powerful article for someone like me to read, you know. Fat serenity. Did I want to be fat and serene? I don't think so. And in my mind, in my world, that's mutually exclusive. I couldn't be both of those anyway. But the article was very powerful. And I read it every day, probably for months, because it takes that long sometimes for things to sink into me. But I started writing down what I was eating, and I went back to seeing what my quantities were, and I even did some calorie counting, which I hadn't done in years. This would have been now probably in the 90s someplace. And I had gone up on my food. I mean, it was a question mark why I had gained the 12 pounds. My quantities were increasing. My snacks were larger. I mean, it was obvious what was happening. And, so, I mean, I think our bodies are really good calculators. I mean, it's not like they just plop on pounds without some reason for it. So, it was a good learning experience for me, because I really reevaluated my food plan, and surprise, surprise, I changed the way I was eating again, and the weight stuff changed. So, I think it's important to kind of evaluate where I am and what is and isn't working. I guess two things are maybe more that jump out at me. One is I actually fell in love with step two during my divorce. And that's sort of become my favorite step of all time. It took me to a new spiritual place I had never been before, because I was reading step two, like, because I was a crazy woman and I had two little kids and I was alone and scared and betrayed and, you know, all that stuff. And my divorce was the most spiritual experience of my life. And I say that really without hesitation now. And I always say, I don't recommend it to anybody. I mean, I don't think it's a reason to get it. But it was that kind of pain, and we all have it in various places in our lives. When that takes us back to God, and in my case, that really happened through step two, that really is a moment. That has a moment, and that changed my life. One of the things that I'm sort of struck by now, I happen to, and I don't remember where we got it, but I go to the Sunday meeting and someone brought some tapes from, I think, an AA conference in the last few months, and I happened to get one, and it was on meditation. You know, the 11th step says thought through prayer and meditation. And, you know, I don't know that we do a great job on the meditation piece in our meetings. Now, for example, so what I started doing at the Sunday meeting when I lead is I say, you know, we usually do something like, you know, a moment of silence. I actually wait till there's actually a moment of silence in that meeting, because usually we're shuffling papers, you know, turning off our cell phones, you know, trying to get comfortable talking to somebody. And I'm getting kind of cranky because I want it to be, you know, after a moment of silence, you know, and I guess I say that because this guy in the tape just gave a profound talk on if we focus only on the food, or in his case he was saying the drinking, we're only giving people a shell of what this program is about. We're giving them nothing, okay? Wish I were as good a speaker as he is, but and then his talk was on meditation, and I'm really glad that Bruce is doing some stuff on meditation at the retreat in a few weeks, and I'm really hoping to be out there for that. So I'm trying to learn. I'm learning from other people and from reading. I've got CDs, and there's even walking meditations, which for me is kind of a good thing to do. But I just have found that to be something I want to learn more about, and I think it's really can be powerful. And I'm hoping that there's other people in OA that feel that loss as well. I just don't know that I've heard us talk about that as much, or at least me live that as much. So if I haven't, I mean, well, I think that's right now where a little bit of my growth edge is. Developing that a little bit. I want to work on that a little bit. And I think there was a thing he did on meditation in the OA, what do we call it? The newsletter. Newsletter, yeah. So anyway, he did it. So I'm really looking forward to that. Is my life perfect? No. Is it better than it would have been? Yep. Do I have a ways to go? Yep. I don't have any magic. There's no magic. So I guess we'll open it up for questions. Thanks.
Okay, we will now open the meeting to questions for the speaker. Please limit your questions to the speaker to share and how he or she works with steps or uses the tools of recovery. We ask that you raise your hand and wait to ask your question until the speaker calls on you.
Thank you so much. You said one phrase, and I think you had it written on your card, about kind of your outlook, and it ended up with the outcome. You're not responsible for the outcome, but you kind of had some things before that that I found I really wanted to hear it again. Would you mind repeating it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so, but I don't have it written down.
Oh, you don't have it.
No, I was probably faking it.
Oh.
The question is, I said something about, oh, I know. Yes, I do know what that is. Thank you. It is, the question is kind of how to repeat something I said earlier. I'm supposed to repeat this one. The method I use is, and this is how I'm trying to center myself, is enter the space, listen carefully, speak the truth, and let go of the results. And I think that's the 12 steps in some, you know, fashion. Yeah.
I'm Marcy.
Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Marcy. I don't have a question. But what really hit me was just the statement that you said, I'm not a firefighter. And I had to write that down because I guess I need to know that I'm not a firefighter. I need to slow down and take it easy. And your talk tonight had a feeling of peace and calmness that I really needed to hear. So I just wanted to say,
oh, thank you.
I need to know I'm not a firefighter.
Thanks.
In regard to your anxiety, how has the program, when were you diagnosed with an anxiety disorder? Was that prior to your food problem? Or I have anxiety and I'm really interested in that, how that works for you.
So the question is a little bit about maybe the timing and anxiety and the eating disorder. I'm not sure I can answer that question. It doesn't mean that I don't want to. But anxiety has been there. It's saturated my experience for so long. It's hard for me to remember when it began. You know what I mean? I'm almost startled when I don't have it. You know, like, I don't feel it right now, but that's almost startling. It's kind of like, you know how one of the 12 steps in the OA book, it talks about how our character defects are woven into the thread of our tapestry of life. Well, that's how kind of anxiety is. I don't really view anxiety as a character defect as much as it is a experience, probably related to childhood stuff and fear. But I can tell you that food makes it worse. You know, I can tell you that when I was binging or when I overeat, my anxiety, it actually feeds the anxiety. And that really awareness didn't come to me probably till the last 5 or 10 years. Computers feed my anxiety because I'm not really good at stuff like that. Exercise actually helps my anxiety, I think. And I think going for a walk is one of the most loving things I can do for myself, as long as I'm not doing the firefighter, you know, routine. All those little things, appreciating or being present in the moment, those are the things that I feel minimize my anxiety. I'm a teacher, and I have to get up in front of large groups of people, and those are not the kinds of things that make me anxious. But, not being perfect or... there are certain situations, maybe at work or something, where I'll feel anxious or at home. But it just seems to have a life of its own. But I do know the food makes it worse. And when I was in the food, that's when my anxiety was the worst. And it's probably the strongest trigger I have right now to compulsively eat is anxiety. Although I can use anything as an excuse to eat. But... So I suspect they kind of percolated along together. And then when I realized that the food, quote unquote, and I'm using quotation marks here, made the anxiety go away, which it didn't, you know. But there's this moment of relief, and I thought, oh my God, if I eat more and I eat more and I eat more, you know, none of those things work. But so they're really interconnected for me, and I'm not sure I can describe it or say any more than that about it. Mm-hmm. It's debilitating.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Something you said right at the very beginning really caught me that I'm curious on how you handle. When you say that you, one of your biggest things is dealing with like the fear of being hit, even though you're not going to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
What is your coping mechanism, today to deal with, when that comes on?
Mm-hmm.
Mine isn't being hit. Mine is like rejection and
sure.
Abandonment and stuff. So it's even though I know it's not going to happen, it's you.
Right. The fear of it happening stays long after the last time it happens. The question is about how to deal with sort of the fear of things that may have happened in the past, and the fear persists long after the last time it happened. One is I've tried to develop some courage. Now, I know and I don't know how to say it. I mean, that's been one of my goals of therapy, frankly, is to, because I let people say and do things and treat me in ways that were disrespectful for me as a child of God. And so one of my goals, I wish I were tall and, you know, statuesque, and, you know, I'm not ever going to be like that, you know, but I feel like that sometimes. So one of, I'm a little bit self-conscious because this is being taped, but I was actually being sexually harassed at work by my boss at one point in the last 10 or so years. And I was too scared to even, to raise it. I was terrified, and it was that fear step. And he wouldn't have hit me. That's not what I was concerned about. I was afraid of other things. It took me years. I think it probably took me, because it continued. It took me probably almost 10 years before I raised a complaint. And I finally did that a year and a half ago. And that was years of therapy and years of having some clarity, not perfect, and having the food reasonably, you know, healthy. So it was a lot of things together, I think, but my therapy has really helped with that. So I wish I had courage all the time. I don't. But courage is actually a muscle, I learned, that we can practice. And, you know, saying no for me to something, like I was invited to something tomorrow night, and I said no to it. Well, it took me years to figure out how to say those things. You know, and I think I said it in a polite way, but nevertheless, it just... So I've learned to practice having some courage as like I would a muscle, you know. And so I just practice little things like saying no, you know, just can't come, and not giving an excuse. You know, that's the other, you know, the other part of fear is we always have to sort of qualify. I see people who have courage just, you know. Naturally. I don't know how they got it, but they got it. But I didn't have that, you know. So I'm still learning how to develop that muscle that we call courage. So there's something called the compassionate warrior that's in a lot of, you know, books and stuff. Well, I'm trying to become, you know, at this advanced, you know, age and stuff, a compassionate warrior and not be so afraid. And I guess one of the things I do is I take risks. I practice taking a little risk, and sometimes I actually confronted, in my world, I'm the only woman in this group of co-workers, and I was in a meeting once where I was being treated disrespectfully in front of this group of men, and all of them up the chain of command from me, and I confronted them in this group. Now, where that came from, I have no idea. That didn't, believe me, that was practicing that courage muscle. And I walked out of there, and I thought, oh, as my daughter would say, oh, my God, how did you do that? I have no idea. But, you know, I now know. And they're a little more afraid of me now than they were before that meeting. And I was right. And that's that part where you speak the truth, you know, those four steps. Well, step number three is you speak the truth. And I did it in a respectful way, but I said, this is not okay. The way I'm being treated here is not okay. And I was very clear. I mean, I wasn't even, my voice wasn't even as high as I am now. But, I mean, I was very calm, but I was angry about what was going on there. So just practicing those kinds of things. I think those are now like God-given opportunities to practice being that compassionate warrior. And they're probably operating out of fear of something. You know, I don't know what's, you know, in their background. But so that's what I've done. Okay, thank you very much.